there is something that is just naturally reality television about watching multiple vote counts tear asunder the dreams of this career Washington creature as he sits there with his neatly coiffed hair and his like a very, very well cut suits. Like, to me, that was fantastic reality viewing.
It's Monday, January 9th, which means it's Media Monday. Today, John Kelly joins me to discuss how the press covered Kevin McCarthy's somewhat embarrassing struggle last week to become Speaker of the House. We'll ask if the coverage was a bright spot for CNN, why following the vote was so hard on Twitter, and why anyone would want the top job in the House. We'll hear about all that and more on today's episode of The Powers That Be. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/powersthatbe, netsuite.com/powersthatbe. That's netsuite.com/powersthatbe. Happy Monday, everybody. I'm joined today by John Kelly. John, thank you for filling in for me on Media Monday when I was gone. Appreciate it.
Peter, I missed you. And I got to tell you, hosting is a lot harder than it looks. I was just staring at this blank teleprompter thinking to myself, what do I say next? How does he make it look so easy, so seamless, so natural? So I'm glad you're back.
So I want to talk to you, John, about last week's drama in Washington with Kevin McCarthy and how the media covered it and what it was like to watch it. I think there's a lot of interesting threads to pull. Obviously, we kick Washington media around a lot on this podcast and maybe sometimes at Puck. But, you know, I thought in some ways they did a really good job. In some ways they did a predictable job. And in other ways they did a bad job in covering McCarthy's slog. Look, we are taping this while the votes are still happening. By the time you listen to this, McCarthy may actually be speaker. As of my last check, about 15 Republicans had voted for him who were holding out. So, you know, momentum is at least on his side. We'll see how many concessions he makes along the way. But first of all, even without media analysis, the drama has been interesting, not just because it's about who gets to be speaker. It really shows how impotent he will be as speaker. And it just shows how tight a lot of votes are going to be in the House over the next 2 years with this slim majority that Republicans have, which might get slimmer if George Santos decides to go back to the NFL or you know, back to starring in movies or whatever he lied about. You know, like, I mean, what a shitty job he's about to have.
What a shitty job he's about to have. And actually, I don't want to overtly criticize such an important institution, but it's term limits, which I know is one of the saboteurs' articles of faith here that they've been, you know, negotiating about. That's not the answer. We actually have to find a way to make these representative jobs more appealing so that we get better people in them. I've had like a number of thoughts about this McCarthy crisis. First and foremost, I think I've watched as much CNN in the last week as I did every week of my life from 2016 to 2020, but like 100 times more than I have in the last year. And a couple of instant observations around the sort of like impotence point that you made. First and foremost, I don't want to kick around Washington media either, but I was thunderstruck by how late, by and large, some of the biggest and most significant media companies were to the notion that McCarthy was really in peril, that he was in for a much more significant fight. Washington media can tend to be a pack mentality. I mean, quite literally, this invented the pool where people don't want to have aberrant thoughts. They tend to agree with one another. But I was just stunned. I think actually the other reason is that McCarthy and his aides for a decade plus have been like prodigious leakers and story spreaders and media influencers, which is part of the ball game, you know. And I think that he's been so valuable that many people just sort of saw it his way, which was that these were mosquitoes that he was going to flick off his shoulder and eventually give them all the kibble they needed to come to his side of the fence. And I think Tina has reported this, that Washington media is obviously deeply and in some ways essentially obsessed with Washington, but has a, in many cases, shallow understanding of what goes on in the rest of the country. This is a big Peter Hamby point. And so I think that a lot of the the momentum of the Boebert Gates, Taliban 20, whatever they're called, was just misunderstood. Like, I think it was underappreciated just how many people in the House truly hate Kevin McCarthy's guts. And, whether it was 20 or down to 7 or whatever it is, that just, people who would literally wanted to watch the guy, ice fishing naked in Siberia in mid-January rather than almost anything else. So there is that. But also, I think we've talked about this in the past too, about 10 years ago, I worked at the Times. I worked with Mark Leibovich a fair bit, and he made a funny offhand observation that has just stuck with me forever. He said, "God, these used to be the jobs that people worked their whole life to assume, and then at some point they just became these sort of stepping stones to get a show on Sirius or go on an Ad Infinitum book tour or become a Fox contributor and basically baseball card signer for life." And sadly, that becomes increasingly true. What's the motivation of Matt Gaetz and Lauren Boebert? I don't know. I don't know how long she's going to be in Congress for. But just stirring the pot and being reckless and not having incentives to govern, I think is really problematic. And I actually think this is, I'm not trying to, Democracy Now! Did not send me here to the powers that be to make this point, but these are actually existential issues when you have people who assume these jobs and don't necessarily value them enough to take them seriously. I'm not a Kevin McCarthy stan. I think the guy is exactly what the media narrative suggests, narcissistic, power hungry, etc. But in many cases, the real 50,000 foot view challenge here is that of this 400 some odd voting body, not everyone is in the chamber for the right reasons.
Yeah, I mean, and I want to talk about CNN's coverage in a second, but John King said that repeatedly on one of the panels he was on. He was just like, and John's been around politics so long at this point, like, he can call bullshit, and he's just like, these people are not in it to govern. They're in it for fundraising and reelection and the conservative media ecosystem. That's a point a lot of people made. I just appreciated that John was pretty blunt about it. But yeah, I mean, we just launched a newsletter at Puck for DC interest called The Best and the Brightest. And obviously that was a tongue-in-cheek title that we borrowed from Halberstam along with the powers that be. But, his take was like, quote unquote, the best and the brightest, like, come to work for, JFK and they can solve the world's problems. C. Wright Mills, who was like a sociologist who wrote a lot about politics in the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s, like, wrote this book called The Power Elite. And he also observed back then that, like, most people in Congress, most people in the Senate were presidents and CEOs or like high level business people or serious like attorneys or people from the academy, or just like, people from like famous families, whether it's the best and the brightest or the power elite. And yes, most of those people were white men at the time. So like, it's good that we have a much more diverse Congress than we did back then. But at the undercurrent of all of that was the notion that there was something better to do in government and public service than just work for General Motors, than just work for local white shoe law firm. And today, and this is an ice cold take, you know, if you are creative and want to do good, like you can start like a venture fund or go work in tech or like there's just like ways that you can both reward yourself financially and feel like you're like doing something that enriches the world instead of, you know, being the like member of Congress from Florida's like 19th district and you go to DC for 2 years and you speak at CPAC and, you know, that's the end game, you know, is just to like get adulation and raise some money.
Oh, and it's actually a very serious, at least to my mind, a very serious economic question. You know, you mentioned starting a venture fund, but it's all very real. And this is, I mean, you know, we sometimes sound like young fogies on this show, but we're both guys in our 40s who saw the economy recreated when we were like in college, where all of a sudden these enormous insta wealth creation vehicles were just amassed before our very eyes. Companies like Snap, but also the venture companies behind them, the evolution of the leveraged buyout business into private equity, where all of a sudden you would see people who'd spent their years as CEOs of very important businesses watch 30-year-olds create, you know, more wealth in their short lifetime than they could have ever fathomed. And Washington was actually late on the joke, and it's a quiet money town. It's not a big money town. You know, we often laugh that you could, you know, an expensive townhouse in Washington is like, you know, a two-bedroom apartment in, you know, Windsor Terrace. But the what is very real is that to be certainly a rank and file backbencher member of Congress is almost to make the same deal you make to go work at the New York Times, where that's your day job, but you're also writing your book on the side and doing your MSNBC gig. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, as a taxpayer here, in all sincerity, these are fixable challenges, and these jobs have to be made more desirable so that the people will want them and they do a better job in them and actually want to hold on to them. One of the charms, and I'm probably misusing that word, of Kevin McCarthy is he actually wants this. I mean, if truly, I was saying to Tina and I were chatting this morning, I was saying this is like desperately trying to buy a house on the San Andreas fault line and being totally cool that your insurance company won't cover it. What's he trying to do here? He's actively trying to fulfill a lifelong dream only to basically be fitted for a suicide vest as he goes through the vote counting. But that's wonderful, because I don't think many of his contemporaries would go through that, or younger people. Look at what happened to the other young guns, right? Paul Ryan got off the greasy pole as soon as he could to take advantage of the Fox boards and, you know, what Heritage Foundation, whatever else. This is the sort of easy money that you get when you've had a job like this. And Eric Cantor, I presume, is in various K Street adjacent roles. Kevin McCarthy wants this, and he's gone to such extraordinary, humiliating lengths to get it that it just boggles the mind.
I was struck last week by the amount of kind of normies in my friend group who are like texting on our group text asking me, since I'm like the political guy in the group chat. They're watching it. They're amazed. They're like, "What's going on? Why would McCarthy do this to himself?" And I'm like, one of my answers is this is a DC Stryver mentality that you might not understand if you haven't lived there or watched Veep. Kevin McCarthy is a combination of Dan and Jonah from Veep. Like, you, whatever gets you closest to the sun at any given moment, that's where you're moving, no matter how ridiculous, shameless, and embarrassing it makes you. He has set a goal for himself that I want to be Speaker of the House, and he's willing to do whatever it takes to get there. The other angle to this is not a lot of other people actually want the job, because it's what you just described. No. Now, Steve Scalise and Elise Stefanik, I'm sure, would like to be Speaker, but they're not going to, like, it seems like they're afraid to knife McCarthy in the back to get there, at least right now. But beyond that, this is why in a different world on the left side of the aisle, like, AOC came out and said this a few years ago. Like, would you ever want to be Speaker? You know her answer was? No, it's too hard. And like, AOC at least like has thoughts about policy and some kind of a coherent ideology when she's not voting present on the Iron Dome or voting against climate investment. But, you know, she said the quiet part out loud, which is like, it's easier to especially when you're like a pseudo celebrity member of Congress, like hang back, sell merch, speak, write a book, do Instagram stories, do funny tweets, and get attention to the point where you can get reelected in your gerrymandered district and call it a day. And like most people in the Republican caucus, you know, maybe a handful of exceptions, don't want to do that. Like the idea that Donald Trump would step in and be speaker, like give me a fucking break. Like he doesn't have the ability to move legislation. And a lot of members don't. They'd rather be bozos in the, you know, peanut in the peanut section, like throwing darts. I'm mixing up so many analogies right there. But that's my answer for my friends who are texting me. But I do want to come back real quick after a break, John, and talk to you about why you think a lot of sort of non-political junkies were paying attention to this House caucus drama, because I think that I think it actually like penetrated the greater population in a way that a lot of congressional stories don't. Hey, Powers That Be listeners, I'm here to tell you that there's no reason to panic the next time you're searching for the perfect gift. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you a curated list of gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. I use Etsy all the time and have for years. I bought my brother some artwork. I bought my wife some jewelry. I even bought a rug for our living room on Etsy. I love it. But there's a lot of pressure around gifting. I usually have a hard time thinking of gift ideas for friends and family members around the holidays or birthdays in my life. And sometimes I get super stressed trying to find the perfect thing. But now with Gift Mode on Etsy, I can search hundreds of gifting personas and find so many incredible items. And I actually just found the perfect gift for a buddy who's just as into Cincinnati sports as I am, a hot cup of Joe Burrow mug. That's right, I found that on Etsy. It's amazing. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Welcome back, everyone. John, it did feel like I was hearing about this House election. Like, it's not as big as a story in the American mind right now, I think, than the murders in Idaho or the Buffalo Bills and the Cincinnati Bengals and the horrible injury we saw on field during the Monday Night Football game last week to DeMar Hamlin. But, you know, it did feel like it crossed over a little bit. Usually process stories under the dome in the Capitol are obsessed over by Washington media and really nobody else. You know, and like a few things rise above that sometimes. Obviously, confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court, January 6 hearings in some cases, other sort of Trump investigations and impeachment. The Trump years sort of brought a lot of focus on the Capitol in a way that, you know, they didn't have before. January 6 was a big example. But like, typically, leadership elections, vote counting, whipping votes, that stuff doesn't really get outside of the Politico CNN bubble. This felt like, I don't know what the numbers are in terms of viewership. It felt like a lot of people were kind of tuning in. And on top of that, I was spent most of my time watching CNN. I thought CNN did a pretty good job this time. I mean, like, they were, yes, showing the votes over and over again. Part of this was the fact that C-SPAN cameras were able to sort of cut away into Congress and like capture scenes of AOC talking to Matt Gaetz. Like, what? Like, that's something you typically don't see because the speaker usually has control over the C-SPAN cameras and what they can and can't shoot. There's no speaker right now, so the C-SPAN director is just having a blast. And, you know, I felt when they went back to the studio, you know, they had a capable group of analysts like Alyssa Farah Griffin, like, obviously used to work for Donald Trump, but before that, she worked for Mark Meadows in the House Freedom Caucus. So she had really good insight there. You know, Caitlin Collins, I think, really understands Republican politics very well. You have Jake Tapper and John King and Dana Bash, who've like covered DC forever. And like, I don't know, I just felt like they had a good stable of analysts who knew what they were talking about. Unlike sometimes when cable networks cover campaign politics, I like roll my eyes and have to turn it off. I felt like they did a good job. And Oliver Darcy actually mentioned this in his newsletter for CNN. Fittingly, about CNN, that like something like over 40 Republicans have appeared on CNN over the last week, like talking about this. And that to me looked like a departure from the Zucker years where CNN was sort of became a liberal network. And this felt like a reversion to form in a good way for CNN, where it's like, okay, Fox, you have Hannity over here advocating for McCarthy and Tucker not, but it was all mostly like, you know, internal Republican warfare. And then MSNBC is kind of inept covering this stuff sometimes, not in terms of their reporters. They have really good reporters on the Hill, and their political reporters are some of the best, I think. But like their sort of punditry, other than my boy Tim Miller, you know, it's just sort of like, you know, typical resistance liberal, like, look at these crazy people. And it just felt like CNN was offering the most genuine insight into what was going on in real time. And that is my take.
I agree with your take. I think that this absolutely became part of the zeitgeist for a couple, you know, pretty simple reasons. First and foremost, you're right that sort of procedural congressional stuff, you know, gavel porn is definitely like the province of CNN traditionally. But there is something that is just naturally reality television about watching multiple vote counts tear asunder the dreams of this career Washington creature as he sits there with his neatly coiffed hair and his like a very, very well cut suits. Like, to me, that was fantastic reality viewing. You know, sitting him sit there as people stood, made absurd speeches, you know, to watch the no number, to adjourn for the evening, the rush of reporters to meet him as he left the chamber and like, you know, locking himself in the speaker's office, which he's already moved into. In a pre-Trump era, these all qualified for what was the closest to sort of tabloid dumb that politics normally got. So I get why this got to the mainstream. It's just how many times does this guy want to stand up in the public square and just get, you know, his ass handed to him? Like, that was appealing to an apolitical audience. And I watched a lot of CNN too, as I mentioned. The airwaves are filled with a lot of former Republican members and a lot of Republican strategists. And it was definitely a you mentioned the Zucker departure. In a Zucker era, this would have been loud, and it would have been bombastic, and it would have been Chiron filled. Actually, funny enough, I feel like there was a fair amount of that on Morning Joe, but not on CNN. It was really a much more civilized sort of breaking news conversation, and with, you know, they did a good job. But I would stress that I think that in this context, a lot of the guests that Oliver is referring to are moderate Republicans who left Congress when these crazies stormed the gates a while back. And also, like, they should be on the air, you know. And part of why indeed why CNN has gone through its own much deliberated transformation is because of McCarthy himself, who is the perfect example of how you couldn't have a normal conversation with a moderate Republican in the Trump era because they were so narcissistic that they drank the Kool-Aid themselves. I mean, you know, we It's easy to sympathize with McCarthy because of what he's going through, but one has to remember that this is a person who criticized Donald Trump after January 6th and then went down to Mar-a-Lago to lick the guy's boots right thereafter. You know, the man believes in nothing. But the other media element that is hard to ignore for me isn't, you know, the success of CNN covering this. It's how feckless the right-wing media has become here. Trump seems to have no juice. This would have his role in whipping votes for McCarthy would have been an enormous story. The role of the Fox News punditry class would have been an enormous story as the Mark Levin creatures of the world tried to sweep aside the saboteurs. And instead, I think we are in an environment where the media that covers in the most genuine way this part of the party is scattered at a level of sort of, you know, fringe podcasts and fringe organizations that is really just beyond the comprehension of the Fox News viewer. It feels really, really distant. And that's been sort of eye-opening to me.
I totally agree with that. One other media point I want to make just watching this is typically, for me at least, and I know everyone's feeds are different, everyone has different social graph, you know, but I do follow a lot of political reporters, Capitol Hill aides, political strategists, and typically, you know, you'd follow a vote count on, at least for me, on Twitter. And I know a lot of my reporter colleagues and people in politics would too. And Twitter was and has been like a great place to follow incremental developments around things like Build Back Better, like Manchin said this, or like today Sinema walked out of this room and now she's demanding this. And like you could follow that. There hasn't been a chronological feed for a long time on Twitter, but up until very recently, you'd at least be able to get a sense of like where things were going on Twitter. And just by looking at it, to the point where you didn't need to turn on cable news anymore like you used to. I have felt, and I'd be curious if any listeners feel this way too, like the feed on Twitter is such garbage right now. They're letting in a lot of weird, shitty ads. The chronology is even more distorted because there's just so much clutter, and I'm seeing things I normally wouldn't see that are taking away from my Twitter experience, which again was never great, often toxic, often annoying, but at the very least you could like sort through the trash and sort of see what was happening on Capitol Hill. But I don't know if this is your experience. I'm being shown accounts, John, from people that I don't follow, and I'm being shown them because I've figured out I follow someone who follows them. And so, yes, if I follow Don Jr. and Don Jr. retweets something, I see it. If Don Jr. likes something, the Twitter feed will show me that Don Jr. has liked something. But what I'm seeing now is that if Don Jr. follows some spray tanned, you know, America First idiot in Palm Beach that I don't follow, I'm being shown the spray tanned idiot's tweets too. And like, I'm also being shown like Good Morning America. Like I'm being shown their tweets because a lot of my followers follow Good Morning America. And I've learned that Good Morning America just basically just like on Twitter shows like funny videos they've stolen from TikTok. Like all of that stuff is getting in the way of me knowing if it's the seventh vote for McCarthy or the 13th vote for McCarthy, or if some member from Indiana has decided to flip. I'm just all of this is to say Twitter has felt more useless in recent weeks under Elon Musk for following things like this than it did before. And that's actually one reason why I did turn on cable news, is because the Twitter experience for following this just felt so corroded.
I agree that it's been an increasingly less useful tool in every way conceivable for this kind of a news event. And I wonder, how much of this can be corrected. The more we've talked about this in the past number of times, these are momentary Twitter frustrations. But I think that the arc of social media is also one where there's a high point in the parabola, and we're just on the downside here. And I don't know if cable news isn't going to be the answer to cable news, but there's no question that maybe this thing is just over.
You know, I think you're right. And as media critics here, our job is to criticize and not offer solutions. So I think that's a good way to end. John, it's good to be back. I will see you in the Slack this week. Thanks for joining me, man.
All right, you bet, man. Thanks. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Peter Hamby. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, and Chris Corcoran, chief content officer and founding partner of Cadence 13.